you are listening to the Dead TV Podcast, and I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Zeneca.
And tonight's episode of the Dead TV Podcast is the third to last episode of Kindred the Embraced, the TV series. And Mr. Zeneca has the episode synopsis and title for us.
All right, tonight's episode is The Rise and Fall of Eddie Fiore, which was originally aired on April 24th, 1996. Brouhaha boss Eddie Fiore hires an assassin from the shape-shifting Asamite clan to kill Julian, but he pays dearly for the betrayal. When Lily hires a private detective to get evidence on Caitlin to discredit her and end her affair with Julian, Frank acquires the photos, which triggers events that threaten to expose the Kindred.
Dun-dun-dun. Which is, this is basically more of Lillian's jealousy streak, which makes no sense considering that in the previous episode, she was screwing with Zane and admitting to Julian, when my bed was empty, he was there to fill it. And I'm kind of like, what? You have clearly had other lovers, and you guys are in a poly relationship. What is your beef, Lily?
You know, it's a running thing with the characters on the show is that they love each other, they hate each other. They love each other, they hate each other. And that's actually mentioned in the episode itself when Lily talks to Caitlin about just that. Not specifically about Kindred doing it, but it's just that, feelings are enhanced.
Yes, they have a girl-girl talk later on in the episode, which we'll get to. The episode opens with Lillian's jealousy at Frank as she is a peeping Tom in his window. Frank is the name of the actor. I meant Julian, excuse me. With the name of Julian's real name being Frank and C. Thomas Howell's character name being Frank.
I know. Yeah. It's confusing.
Yeah. But Lillian is spying on Julian with Caitlin, watching them make out, and her eyes are glowing and glowing with those context or early CGI, however they did it. And then she meets up with the private investigator, which is also Frank and Julian's bromance spot.
Yeah.
With the hot Kindred waitress.
Yeah, they're going to the Nighthawk Diner, and she just kind of appears and disappears to the PI.
Yes.
So I'm not sure what she feels that will accomplish, maybe intimidate him a little bit by just poof disappearing on him.
Yeah.
But she hands him photographs, which I thought was kind of weird at first. You're handing a private detective photographs when he's supposed to be taking the photographs, but maybe it's just photographs of the two people, and then just a buttload of money, like a fucking buttload of money in this envelope. It's all $100 bills. There must be at least $10,000 in there.
Which she probably has acquired over A, owning that club, B, being a vampire and just acquiring wealth, C, being Julian's girlfriend, so she has access to his bank account too.
Yeah.
He's probably no short of wealth. You know what I mean? He probably never has to check his bank account statement.
I wouldn't think so.
He probably has a Kindred accountant or a human accountant doing that for him that he never has to worry about it ever.
I think so. And even if there was an obstacle in his path, he is a Ventru. So he has that dominate power that can really just break into someone's mind and make them do what he wants them to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, sure, you're going to sign over your company to me. That's great.
Yeah.
That's all he needs.
Is that mind control? Is that what we would be calling that?
Yeah. He exerts his will upon another. So that's completely like a mind control power.
Definitely.
So then the storyline, we'll go through this episode here. So the storyline switches to Eddie Fiore. And so since this is the rise and fall of Eddie Fiore, his storyline is really about betrayal and the political strategies of the Kindred.
Mm-hmm.
I think this episode captured it more so than any other episode, because there's subterfuge, there's lying, there's, people that are disguising themselves as other people. It's, you don't really know who you're talking to because the Asamite clan gets in there. So it's really interesting. You have to pay attention to this episode a lot because there's so much going on and the motivations of each person are different. And they might have even been different than a previous episode. Because, what happens between Cash and Sasha, in the Zane episode there, she was all head over heels for Zane. And, episode before that, she was all head over heels for Cash, and she's been going back and forth, and then, you know, Lily has been going back and forth with Julian, like, whether she's jealous or whether she hates him, and this episode kind of culminates all of that angst.
Mm-hmm.
Really, this vampire angst. People just interfering with each other's lives, and so Eddie is talking to his sire, and the, which is his name is Cyrus.
Cyrus.
Cyrus. So he's the primogen of L.A.
He's the prince of L.A.
Oh, sorry. The prince of L.A.
Yeah, he's probably the primogen of. But you're also right. He's probably the primogen of the Bruja clan there, since he sired Eddie Fury.
Yeah. So because the Bruja are kind of a violent, criminal,
gangster-like.
Yeah, they're very mobster-like. They run their clan a lot like a mob gang.
By the way, did you also notice, other than Sasha, we actually get to see another Bruja female in this episode?
Which one?
She has no name. She has no name. She literally stands around, does nothing until the end of the episode, then she pulls a gun out, and then that's it.
Oh, yeah, she was Asian, too, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, yeah. All we see is her legs, that she's in a business, like a pant, like a skirt suit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, she's mafioso looking like the rest of them and does absolutely nothing.
Nothing. No. They're very one-sided there, I think.
Yes, they're very selective about the women they take, except for Sasha.
Except for Sasha, but that was a revenge thing. You
yeah,
know?
And Sasha does not dress like the rest of the Bruja either. She dresses like Sasha.
Yeah. Okay. So Cyrus and Eddie are talking, and Eddie is just really wanting Julian dead. You know, after Julian, like, took him out on that drive and almost killed him, I can see how he's got, like, this hard-on for Julian. And, like, he wants to squash the enemy that had just, you know, really trounced his pride.
But in other contexts, since you said hard-on for Julian, I bet you he would just love to take Julian.
Well, you know, 1,000 years does get kind of lonely.
You love what you hate.
Yeah, it's just two sides of the same coin.
You know, we all hate Donald Trump, but we must secretly love him.
Donald Trump, man. I don't like Donald Trump, and I make no bones about that. I think he's an idiot. I think he's a fraud. I think he's a shyster, and I think that he's taking advantage of all of the money that we're paying for taxes to pay for his stupid little whatever he wants to do. But
I think he's more like a Bruja than anyone else, too.
Huh?
He's like a Bruja.
He's too stupid to be a Bruja. And that's even saying something, because Bruja are pretty dumb.
Whoa, careful there. You might have some Bruja players listening who'd be like, what is she saying? I'll go down to Pennsylvania and show her.
Bruja definitely has some very good qualities. They are great with strategy, and uh-huh. They are very great with knowing when to use force and when to pull it back. But Donald Trump, he's just a loudmouth.
Yeah.
And that's not what Bruja do.
No.
You know, if Donald Trump was a vampire, I would actually say he would probably be, not Tremere, because he's not really a magic user.
But he is a businessman, too, so he could also be Ventru.
Yeah, but I think his mouth would be too much. I think he would really be a Toreador.
Oh, really? What? Yeah. Wait, he's not an artist in any way. Unless that wall looks like the most magnificent piece of art we'll ever see on the Mexican border.
No, hear me out. So, the Tremere's finer qualities is that they are, you know, for one, beautiful. He is not beautiful. But they have a presence that cannot be denied. You know, when they enter a room, all eyes look at them for that moment of, like, awe.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens with Donald Trump. Maybe it confuses the mind enough to not realize everything out of his mouth is just a lie and a fabrication or just an egomaniacal rambling. But he steps into the room and people pay attention to him. And that's always been his MO. You know, in any sort of media, television, movie spots, you know, cameos on things, it's always about his presence. And that type of just overwhelming aura that he has, that can confuse people. I think that is a Toreador skill.
Okay.
So if he was a blood-sucking vampire, he would be Toreador in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if he was a blood-sucking creature, it would be probably more Leech.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a hot chick sitting on Eddie Fury's lap with his shirt half unbuttoned, and his sire reveals to him that this is the assassin, the Asimite that he hired, using very kind of coy way of saying, you know what the thing is about Asimites? You never know when they gotta be around, Eddie. You know what the thing is about Asimites? I kind of talk like this the whole episode.
and so it,
I think I belong in Goodfellas, like, instead of this TV series.
Maybe it's some broad you picked up at the bar.
Yeah.
Okay, for one, even before this person was revealed to be an Asimite, you knew something was up. Because they're talking about killing someone in front of this broad that they picked up at the bar.
Yeah.
You wouldn't talk about killing someone in front of someone you don't know. So automatically she has to either be kindred or be part of their own clan.
Also, did Eddie pick her up at the bar and she just not say anything? She just nod or shake her head? Because this Asimite doesn't say anything the entire episode.
Yeah, the Asimite doesn't have any lines whatsoever. And it's Cyrus that actually suggests that he picked her up at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Which is probably Haven, so...
Yeah, because there's no other bars apparently in San Francisco.
We haven't seen any.
No.
So, you know, the Asimite changes into a guy and then changes back to a girl and, you know, proves that, you know, the Asimite can pretty much, you know, go wherever and not be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So he's, Eddie Fiori's feeling a little uneasy about this because he just had this woman on his lap, probably with the intent of getting her into the bedroom at some point. And now it's like, oh, you're an assassin. All right, then. Maybe I should just check out my process of elimination and not pick up that person again. You know, that type of uneasiness where, you know, his sire has just blown his mind and he doesn't really like it.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to the Haven, and Julian and Cash are meeting with Eddie and Cyrus to work things out, because Cyrus basically said that before he attempts to assassinate Julian, he has to make the appearance as if they're working it out. Mm-hmm. So they go to the club, they're working it out, and of course, you know, Sasha is stirring the pot. Why does she do this? She stirs the pot. You know, Cash is, like, trying to say that he's working, he shouldn't need to, he doesn't have time to talk with her, and she's not helping him, she's just being a distraction, and at every turn, like, there's multiple points in this whole episode that I thought the Asimite assassin was actually playing Sasha's role, but every time that it happened, it wasn't the assassin.
No. But,
just certain things that Sasha did, I thought was too in line with the Bruja's plans to really be a mistake, even though she said clearly over and over that it was a mistake. It had nothing to do with what the Bruja was planning to do. It was just her.
Yeah. Do you know what the song is that's playing at the club when Cash basically, like, walks off from Sasha?
No, what's the song?
I don't know either. I couldn't find any information about it. That's the problem.
No, throughout this episode, because since the Asimite are a clan that typically heralds from the Middle East, Mediterranean area,
yep,
they use a lot of music with that Middle Eastern influence. So I couldn't identify any of the actual music, but the Middle Eastern chords that aren't really right for the nightclub setting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can hear that people talking a bit more than the music, and at a typical nightclub that doesn't happen. Yeah, you know, so I thought it was a little odd that they changed the music, but I, you know, for television they're trying to have this illustration that the Asimite are from the Middle East, even though none of the characters are.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty interesting regarding the music.
Lillian and Sasha have a moment above the club as they just are both, you know, the men that they want can't be with them when they want them to be. So it's, you know, they both basically have a job to do. Well, I mean, Julian wants to go bang Caitlin, and Cash has his duty to Julian, and that's why he can't be with Sasha. But it just, it's kind of written like, but I want to fuck now, and you need to go do a job, not like... no, there's like this giant war and conflict happening and all this tragedy happening going on in the last several episodes. And that's why we can't be together. It's Sasha, I have to go to work, and she's all mopey, and I'm like, that's a badly written character arc in this episode.
Yeah, I think I counted three times where Sasha and Cash went from I love you to I hate you to I love you to I hate you. It just kept going back and forth.
Also, I think this episode should have happened after Sasha was embraced and before the Zane yes. Singer episode, because it yes. really feels completely out of context with everything else going on. And Sasha's whole, like, I need the D now, where she, like, stalks him back to Julian's place, like, I need you. Why? That makes no sense.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Get your hormones in check, woman.
that sudden change from being into Cash to being totally about Zane felt really difficult.
It felt
like we were missing an episode, and I think this one was probably, you know, the Cash and Sasha storyline was probably what needed to be in between that and her attraction for Zane.
Yeah, completely. It just so out of order, I think, a little bit with the plot summary, because they don't make any mention of what happened with Zane. It just also with Lillian's comment in the previous episode to Julian about like my bed was empty and he was there to fill it, you know, that would have been more of an allusion to like Julian and Caitlin's relationship getting closer together. Which in the next episode we get to, they get really close together. The sequence of events just seem a little out of order with the context of what they're saying and how it's written. So,
And Lily goes to explain how the Kindred have these strong feelings, and that even though there's a way that she could make Sasha not feel things, Lily feels that removing the sense of passion in a vampire's life is kind of a disservice. Like,
yeah.
Don't you want to feel that?
Yeah.
And admittedly, it's hard for Sasha because like she can heal physical wounds very well, like seconds. You know, she can heal a physical wound, but she's going through this heartache because her blood is saying, "I hate the Gangrel," and yet she loves Cash. And you know, as I said, love and hate are two sides of the same coin. It's that passion, and she's having difficulties with it, and Lily is also having difficulties with it because she is so wrapped up in this drama that she's creating for Julian. You know, she is just jealous all the time over his relationship with Caitlin, and in this episode goes through great lengths to further that. It's kind of astounding just how much she herself is forwarding the drama.
Mm-hmm. The gift that Julian gives to Caitlin, the telescope, and like doing the whole romantic thing. By the way, he's in and out of there really fast with that whole setup of the thing. I think this is gonna be like the night he spends the night or something. But he comes in there, he sets it up, and then he leaves, and you're like, wow, that was pretty fast. But I actually did that same thing once for my ex-wife, and she just kind of wasn't into it. I didn't buy her a telescope, but I had like created a whole romantic dinner, candlelights outside. I strung up the Christmas tree lights outside. I made the dinner, and then I set up the telescope to show her something in the sky, and she just wasn't into it when I did it.
She wasn't into it?
No.
Aw,
yeah.
That's a shame.
Yeah. So I tried that, what Julian tried, and Julian didn't get laid from Caitlin, so I guess he struck out as much as I did.
Yeah, he's I don't know how many times he's attempted it by this point, but she even makes mention that he must be getting tired of saying no.
Yeah, basically.
Hearing no.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Nightcrawler is continuing to take pictures of everything that's going on, including the Asomite trying to kill Julian. And Nightcrawler, by the way, is a reference to the Jake Gyllenhaal movie that came out, I think, last year or the year before, where he is, like, hunting down stories by any means necessary.
Yeah. And one thing that is kind of interesting is that the pictures don't capture the shape-shifting of the Asomite. You know, they have a picture of the person as Billy, the gangrel thug. Yeah, they don't really go into Billy's character too much, but
Billy's been around since the first episode. Poor Billy.
Yeah, but they never really introduced him. This is the first time I heard his name.
Oh no, wait! I thought he was called Billy before.
You know, if he was, I didn't catch that.
I swear to God, I thought Cash had called him Billy once before. Like we'd seen him since the first episode. What was the name of the guy who was spying on Frank and Julian's old girlfriend? And she drops him off right in front of the mansion?
Yeah.
But
she didn't call him by the name. She called him by a slur.
I thought...
Your dog.
Yeah, your dog. But I thought that was Billy, too, because later on in the deleted scene that's put back into episode one, Sasha calls him Billy?
Okay. Well,
yeah.
I guess this time is the first time I actually noticed it.
Okay, but he dies.
Yeah, he dies.
He gets his head chopped off.
And the PI doesn't actually capture that shapeshift.
It doesn't capture the guy getting his head cut off either.
No, just that the body's on the ground.
Yeah. Good job with that camera, by the way.
He must have seen it. You know, he was there taking photos. But the bodyguard changes into a woman, and Julian struggles with the woman, and then... you know, leaves. So I would have thought that if you're constantly taking pictures of a crime in progress, you would actually capture that shapeshift and have it noticeable, but I don't think he really understood what he was capturing.
True, yeah. He's probably completely confused because he didn't want to take the job to begin with when he slides the money back through and is just like, yeah, no. You want me to go out to Julian Luna?
He heard the name Julian and was like, oh, no, that's trouble I don't want to get myself into.
I love later on when after this whole thing goes down and we're back at the Haven once again, which, by the way, where do we have any information? I couldn't find it either about where the Haven Club is located in California, or if this was filmed in California, and like what the name of the actual club is.
No, because I think in one of the commentaries they said that the exterior was filmed in one location and all they added was the Haven sign.
Oh, okay. So the inside is probably a soundstage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do did love. You know, whoop, go ahead.
Did you notice the weapon that the Asomite was using?
That kind of giant curved blade, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That curved blade is called a kukri.
Okay.
A kukri.
It's
kind of a curved blade with an inward angle. So it's kind of like a machete. It has the same type of length as a machete, but it's curved inwards.
Okay.
And it's specifically used for beheadings.
Oh, yeah. I've,
So it makes sense that the vampires would actually use this blade, since, you know, one of the ways you can kill vampires is just by beheading them.
Yeah, definitely. Now, before we get to the Bruja bitch line of the episode, why don't you go into some information about the Asomites and how they are, like, the bone of existence to players in the game, and a great little... trope that storytellers love to use to throw in there for their storytelling when we're playing Vampire the Masquerade.
Yeah. Okay. So the Asomite clan is very interesting. I really have a lot of good information on the Asomite, but there's a lot of information. So I won't go into a lot of details, just kind of an overall gloss here. But Asomite are not called Asomite inside the clan. Asomite is kind of what I make the analogy that a white person would call a Native American family, you know, grouping a tribe. They don't really call themselves tribes. You know, they call themselves peoples. So the Asomite don't call themselves Asomite. They call themselves the children of Hakim. And Hakim is actually the original sire as they put the clan Hakim is the second generation from Cain, so he's not directly like a Nosferatu is. It's a second generation from Cain. So he is actually a surviving member. As far as I know, and our listeners can correct us here, but as far as I know, Hakim is still currently living or has lived up until maybe like a few hundred years ago.
Dun, dun, dun!
Yeah. So basically the Asimites are the originally a neutral clan. They restore order. And that was their job. Their job was basically the judges in the second city. So they are the keepers of the rule. So when a leader of the city or the hierarchy structure puts down a rule, the Asimites were there to judge and therefore execute the people who were going against the rule of law.
Uh-huh.
So one of the quotes that the Asimite will use is that we were asked to stand in judgment, and the other clans walked off and left us. So they have no right to complain if we still do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a clan that's very regimented. Like within the clan itself, there are three castes, and each of these castes are for a very distinct set of childers.
Now, by the way, you cannot play as this clan in the game, right?
I think you can.
Oh, you can? I didn't think you could.
There's a clan book.
Oh.
There's a clan book, yeah.
Okay. Then why doesn't anyone ever play as an Asimite? I've played in two Vampire the Masquerade games for many months before one other reason or another I had to leave.
Well, did you have a follower of Set in your...
No.
That's probably why.
Okay, that's probably... Okay, then that's what it is.
The followers of Set and the Asimites are rivals
The
same general location geographically.
And the storyteller that we have coming on the show for the final episode of Kindred the Embraced, we might actually... I might ask him about why we didn't use that at all, because he's the storyteller... Or he's one of the storytellers for the game that I used to play, so...
Cool. Yeah, Asimites gather their childers and they sire specific people. So there's three castes within the clan. There's the warrior caste, which are called caliph, and there's the scholars, which are viziers, and the sorcerers, which are emirs. So the leaders, the caliph, vizier and emir, they make up a coalition called the Duat. And the Duats are basically the highest levels of the Asimite, and they rule on things as kind of a team, from my understanding of it. And then backing them up is a group called the Sil Sila, which are Keepers of the Blood. So they're the devotees of Hakim, and they're very high up there. They're more of the spiritual scholars.
Mm-hmm.
And so they keep the traditions alive. But the caliph of the warriors is the most prolific warrior. Like, the way that the Asimite dole out their promotions are basically the numbers of people that you killed, so that in the warrior clan, I should say, in the warrior clan. So when you start out, you're a fida. Probably not pronouncing that correctly, but it's fida,
mm-hmm.
and that's a devotee.
Gotcha.
Then you rise up a little bit more, and then you become a rafiq, and a little bit more, and that's a dai, and that's a summoner, like a summoner or a missionary. And then you reach ace status, which is a relatively new term, but ace. Once you've killed five or more non-Asimites greater or equal to your power, then you reach that ace level. The warriors, the caliph of the warriors, has to be the most prolific warrior, the hardiest, the strongest of them, and then the same for the viziers and the emirs. So the emirs are the sorcerers, and the emirs and viziers have different levels as well. So there's the aspirant, associate, master, full master, etc. And they kind of relegate their knowledge together, and they judge based on the rules of the land. So I find it very interesting in this episode how it's said that the Asimite only will work for princes of cities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find any conflicting information in that, in the clan books. But I have, of course, have not played an Asimite, so my knowledge here is a little bit limited.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things is that the Asimite that they're using has a normal skin tone.
Okay.
So that means that that Asimite is only 5 years old to 50 years old.
Oh, my.
Because once they reach 50 years old, their skin starts to darken. And that's one of their key visual cues, that you can actually tell an Asimite's age by the color of their skin. It's kind of racist, I know. But,
yeah.
But between 50 and 100 years, their skin starts to darken up until it reaches like 1,000 years, where their skin is absolutely obsidian black and kind of shiny.
Oh, okay. I have seen that in certain images before of what Asimites are to look like.
Yeah, so it's really interesting in that the older you are, the more you kind of develop those three major disciplines of the Asimite, which is celerity, which is speed,
uh-huh.
and obfuscate, which is, you know, the ability to become invisible, or, you know, obstruction of visual,
uh-huh.
and quietus, which is to move silently.
Okay.
So as their skin gets darker, that only enhances these abilities, the ability to remain hidden, the ability to remain quiet, and all of their judicial skills are in keeping the peace, but they don't really have much in the way of alliances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're a fairly neutral sect, and most of the other clans don't really like them. You know, they don't really get along with anyone, especially the followers of Set.
Okay.
Know, they have some, you know, pretty pretty deep grudges. But they do use, like, blood magic, and the people that they pick are, you know, the warriors, the wizards, the sorcerers, intellectuals, scholars, that type of thing. So they want the best of the best.
The best of the best, sir!
Best of the best. You know, they're not savages. They don't do any sort of blood bonds. So unlike the Toreadors that actually do a lot of blood bonds,
okay.
they actually consider blood bonds to be a form of punishment that is distasteful.
Ah.
They don't do it unless someone has proven that they can't handle free will.
Gotcha.
So that's almost like a judgment of their character. Like, you can't handle free will, so we're going to take it away from you and punish you for forever with this blood bond.
And that has been another chapter of The World of Darkness by White Wolf Gaming, as read to us by the amazing Mistress Zeneca. Now, coming back into the episode, again, the line that really catches me off guard, which I always love hearing, and I have said this in game before, under my breath, is Bruja bitch. I fucking love that. You're Bruja bitch. I was like, ow! Oh my god, I'm not a woman and that hurts.
That was a cunt pun, right?
That was really right in the freaking crotch. And I love the fact that she's got this hate and anger, and all I could hear is the Emperor's voice. I could feel the hate rising inside me. You take your weapon and strike me down, and your journey to the dark side would be complete. Let go of your anger, young Skywalker. Only your hate can destroy me. The entire time, every time I keep hearing anger and hate, all I keep thinking is Emperor Palpatine being all like, I can feel it welling up inside you. Good, good. Give in to the hate. And then Lois Griffin coming out of nowhere pushing him going, you're not helping.
So Cash is getting flack from the rest of the gang girls on just having Bruja
booty call.
They've seen them together.
Yeah, I mean.
So now that she's turned, they're like, you know, what is this crap?
Do you think they'd have a little bit more sympathy considering the fact that they know how the hell it happened to her?
Yeah.
Like, you're a bitch for even thinking about it. You should be like, oh my god, Sasha, we love you. Even though you're a Bruja, we know you're not quite like the other Brujas because you were banging Cash before you became a Bruja. No. And then, of course, she also blames Julian. She's just like, you could have turned me into a Ventru like you, but I'm Bruja now, and life sucks, and I'm angry all the time. I'm like the Hulk.
It's also weird that she admits to that she admits to blaming him for not turning her sooner.
Yeah.
And he said, Julian says that he doesn't blame her at all for anything that she's done. The robberies, the disrespect, any of it.
No, because he wants her to have like a full life and make her own mistakes so she'll learn and be a productive member of society, whether it be vampire or human. We get back to the diner, and my favorite waitress of all time is there once again. I kind of find out who that actress's name is. It's going to kill me. And Lily is, like, looking just absolutely gorgeous for a meeting with this detective who he mentions, I have a contact on the force. Is it Frank? Yes, of course it's Frank, because he had to show up at some point in this episode. He was probably off making, like, Bloodlust, Revenge is a Dish or something like that, or some other cheesy, crappy direct-to-DVD or direct-to-VHS at the time movie. That's why he's only halfway through the episode. And we actually get, for the first time, to see Lillian actually kill somebody. We've not seen Lillian kill anybody.
Yeah, yeah. She follows the PI because the PI threatens to keep the negatives from her.
Yep.
She paid him a boatload of money, and she wants those negatives to the pictures because, of course, you know, it's portraying Julian in a bad light. And he, not so subtly, drops a bomb that he thinks that he can make more money off of Julian with these photos. So he's basically saying that he's going to blackmail Julian over these. So, you know, Lily, being this, like, love-hate type of thing with Julian, follows him, you know, follows him to Frank's place, and then in the elevator, just attacks him,
kills
him,
murders him right there
in the elevator.
Yeah, and then goes right to Frank's apartment.
Yep.
Because Frank is expecting a kindred to show up because he knows the photos are connected to Julian Luna, and he's just like, oh, it's you. I wasn't expecting the Nosferatu or something.
Yeah.
And she's just, like, in his apartment, and she's, like, all over him, and she's just oozing this sexual energy that is just, like, I mean, it's like a cat and a canary, you know?
She's trying to tempt him into accepting vampirism.
Basically. And she basically just, like, grabs him and kisses him and then hugs him, you know, as they're so close to each other, and you're just like, this is the yum-yum moment of the episode. These two, because there was no bromance in this episode, by the way. These two, there's not even bromance between Cyrus and Eddie, because they don't have that type of relationship.
Yeah, they don't have that type of relationship.
No, so there is no bromance in this episode. But there is a yum-yum moment, and that comes from Lillian's sexual attraction to Frank.
Yeah, and Frank kind of ends up a little bit in her arms.
Yeah, it's so adorable, too, though.
Yeah, she's whispering into his ear, kind of behind his back, like a temptress, and she.
You see yourself in Lillian's position, don't you?
Huh?
You see yourself in Lillian's position, don't you? In this episode.
Always, but maybe not the stirring of the pot type of thing. I tend to not want that much drama in my life.
No, true. Maybe the pot-stirring crap completely aside, because you like to have your relationships be a little less friction-oriented, but you have your own kind of haven in Pennsylvania. And you do have your...
I love my devoted followers.
You have your devoted followers, and they come to you for their advice, and you have your primary lover, and you have your separate... people,
subs that I mentor.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a very extended. It's not a harem. It's
No.
It's just a whole bunch of people that rely on me for different facets of their life.
Yes.
And I rather enjoy it.
Do you watch these episodes alone? Do you watch these episodes alone, or do you watch them with your fiance or someone else, just to be like, get kind of like compare like notes from them as well to about the episode? Do they ever make a comment about Lillian?
Sometimes I'll watch it with my partner.
Okay.
most of the time I'll watch them by myself just because I'm pausing the show every 3 seconds.
Oh, that can be annoying, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and then you watch the episode again with the commentary, and then you watch the episode again, and you fill in what you missed with your notes.
Yeah. So, what I recommend for Constantine is you watch it like with your partner for once, because
the first time you've ever seen it,
and then rewatch it for your note taking.
My partner is a huge Constantine fan. Like, oh. Huge. I have on my shelf right behind me every trade paperback.
Oh, you should take a picture of that and post it to the Facebook page to just be like, coming soon, very soon.
I will probably on the last week of the show, I will like tease that. But yeah, I've got Hellblazer comics and Constantine's, like, I'm trying to actually find the John Constantine Swamp Thing crossover when he's actually introduced and he starts to actually learn from Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Swamp Thing is revealed to be a plant elemental.
That happens in like two. He has two first appearances that happen pretty much at the same time. One is more the first appearance than the other, only because they came out a week ahead of time. But they both come out within the same month. There is the issue of Swamp Thing that you're going to look for, the very first appearance of John Constantine. And then there's also Crisis on Infinite Earths number 7 is also considered like the second first appearance of John Constantine.
Cool.
Yes, as the DC Universe was colliding in on itself and reformatting for the events of Crisis. And John was introduced into that, just like he was then introduced into the normal DC Universe just before the Flashpoint in the New 52 in the Search for Swamp Thing miniseries. And then that brought John out of the Vertigo Universe into the regular DC Universe. It's all one universe, depending on what stories they pick, kind of thing. But he had never made an official DC comic book appearance outside of the Vertigo Universe up until that moment.
So I'll be watching Constantine with him, and he'll be adding his information to it. And I'm also reading the comics.
Okay, good. So. But let's get right back to this, as I got us completely off track. Eddie being a dickhead in the when he meets up with Lillian in his personal space, dude, you're kind of a creeper, is what I wrote down for notes. Like, Jesus Christ, I mean, just no.
Okay, so here's the shell game with these pictures here. So Lillian orders the pictures. The pictures are taken. She sees the pictures at the diner. The pictures, the negatives in the pictures, are then taken to Frank, and she sees them at Frank's house, doesn't retrieve them because he also gives them to Caitlin. So Caitlin saw the pictures, and Julian saw the pictures. So everyone is seeing these pictures. No one really mentions where the negatives are. It's assumed that they're still with Frank, but she killed the PI, so no one knows for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Lily is trying to set up Caitlin to be fired from her job for having an inappropriate relationship with her boss. Eddie is trying to get Julian killed so that he can take over as prince.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie approaches Lily about supporting him in this endeavor. And Lily is so pissed off at Julian for calling her out on having a PI take these pictures that she agrees to this.
Which is just, like, yeah, which is basically just bad, like, karma on her.
And so then
we have the meeting at the Haven with the two women just being, like, intrinsically beautiful with each other. I mean, Caitlin is just, like, stunning in this scene with Lily, and you'll have to notice a couple things that Lillian's like when they're holding their wine glasses. I took a really good look at their hands, and Caitlin has very normal looking nails, but Lillian's nails are sharpened to points.
Because I think that's supposed to represent, one, her vampirism, and two, that she's actually saying everything in that scene with a taste of venom.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Everything in there. So like, there's the quote, like. Well, I won't say the quote, but Lily is actually mirroring the horrors that Caitlin is actually portraying in her attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So Caitlin is really, like, Caitlin goes to the club, even though she basically breaks up with Julian in the scene before. It's very quick. Like, she saw the photos and then she freaks out. She says, "Right, I
that can't be part of your world."
Yeah, and then she still goes to the club. with the hope that she might see him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she just broke up, you know, it's this kind of love-hate back-and-forth thing. When she talks to Lily, she's just Lily mirrors to her the horrors of their world without even saying anything about the masquerade or any of that. The comment that about Caitlin and her risk to the masquerade is that if Caitlin found out, would she warn everyone or would, you know, it prompt people hunting them?
True.
Like, how deep is Caitlin's loyalty if she were to find out the truth? And since this whole thing kind of freaked her out in the beginning, there's a good chance that she would freak out even more and then, you know, as a journalist, just warn people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really the crux of it. Like, she's a serious danger to the masquerade. Lily sees that, but it's so covered with her intense jealousy over her that she can't get a logical argument out to Julian about why Julian needs to break up with her.
True. Then we go back to Julian's place, and Lillian's there, and the lame is like, I just came over for you to hold me. And I knew immediately either that wasn't Lillian or just was just more terrible writing. So I'm like, that really? You came over for a fucking hug? What?
No.
I'm sorry. What?
That was completely out of character. And of course, the Asmite wouldn't know what Lily's character truly is.
Yeah.
So that was completely suspect. And Julian knew in a second.
Yeah. And if
so
you believe.
When the knife came out, no surprise.
Yeah. And then, of course, Julian goes upstairs to. Cash is like, give me your gun. Eddie's there, turns around, blasts Julian away. Julian is dead. Not really, obviously. However, it's just kind of poetically unfortunate that his character dies in the show 2 episodes before his character, the actor who plays him in real life, dies, unfortunately.
In a motorcycle accident.
Yeah. Kind of weird in a sick and twisted poetic kind of way. That, you know, you die in your work, that you die in real life, you know? Look at, you know, Brandon Lee died as the Crow in the movie, dies in real life. The Fast and Furious actor drives really fast in the films, dies in a car accident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But by that record, you know, what's that one actor that's always dying in every single media?
Sean Bean,
that's it.
Yeah. By the way, I cannot find the name of the Asimite actress on IMDb. I don't know if she has another name. There is a character called Marissa, played by Blair Velk.
Don't remember anyone mentioning the word Marissa.
Yeah, but I don't... I mean, there's another character named Lorraine as Kimberly Hooper. There's no photos of who... Okay, so Kimberly, by the way, is the kindred waitress that keeps popping up. Her acting career ended in 2000. She hasn't done anything since. But Blair Valk could be the kindred Asimite. Again, she has, like, no real career other than this show and, like, a couple bit parts here and there. So I have no idea if this
is... And she didn't have any lines, so
no.
She probably wasn't paid that much for the gig.
Correct. The only other actresses listed in this episode are, the waitress, Marissa, Lorraine, Kimberly Campbell. Kimberly Campbell is the waitress. For some reason, IMDb has her listed twice under the same name. This is, like, I think a flub with IMDb. Yeah. Anyway, so... by the way, poor Mark Frankel, who plays Julian Luna, he doesn't even get a picture on IMDb.
What?
Nope.
He's a gorgeous man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And his acting career starts in 1990. I mean, he was on another TV series for 18 episodes. He was on another TV series for 14 episodes. These were both canceled, unfortunately. And then he was on Kindred. And he's got... Yeah, I mean, I'll admit that he is a handsome-looking dude.
Yeah. And if you take a look at his eyes, and they mention it a couple of times, but one eye is slightly blue and the other eye is brown. So only in certain scenes where the light hits his eyes in a certain way can you see that difference.
Yeah.
Which works very well for a vampire because that otherworldly eyes type of thing.
Also, I thought it was
just a handsome guy.
Yeah, totally. I just absolutely stunning. He could have had a great long career if it wasn't for that accident. Couple quick notes before we go to speed up the wrap up of the episode. The Asimite takes a long time to change back into its Asimite form, and it's just obviously, okay, Jillian, you get up and act Asimite actress, now you lay down. And we don't get to see the transformation ever, but that might have been due to special effects. Lillian shows up at Daedalus's crypt, and she's acting like she is completely drunk, which means she probably got like wasted on wine to get over the pain of betraying Julian.
She says that she feels the weight of all the blood on her hands.
Yes, and then Daedalus slashes his little picture in a fit of rage. Of course, I don't know if he's in on the Julian's scam that Cash is on, because Cash obviously sees Julian right away. Shouldn't Daedalus been able to sense that Julian is still alive? Shouldn't Lillian been able to sense they've had sex? They've clearly drinking each other's blood. You can't tell that your lover is still alive?
I don't know, because I think Daedalus did not know, because the shriek that he lets out once Julian steps into the room and reveals that he's not dead.
So overacted.
It is overacted, but it's a very, very strong point that I had no idea, and this is freaking me out.
What? You're still alive?
And so Eddie goes and is asking for loyalty from all the Primogens, and says that blood must be spilled, or he's okay with blood being spilled. And then Lily agrees and hacks him with a samurai sword.
Yeah, you know, kiss my ring. Beheads him. Kiss my ring.
goes right there.
He just like passes the ring around. Kiss my ring. Kiss my ring.
Yeah. And that's another thing, is that a prince only has power if the Primogens give him that power.
Correct. And they gave it to Archon, because he didn't want a war anymore. And Eddie is just kind of a bruiser. So, and one little thing that we forgot to mention about Lillian's little makeout session with Frank is that if Eddie Fury becomes prince, Frank's life is done.
Course.
Because he's been a thorn in the kindred side this whole time, and he'll kill Frank, he'll kill probably Sonny, because he knows Sonny betrayed him, which, by the way, they never ever go back to. Eddie gets his head cut off. Eddie is dead. They never ever address the fact that Eddie clearly knows that Sonny was a double agent the whole time. And they never ever touch upon that. There's no deleted scene on the box set either about it. There's no mention in the commentary for the episodes about it. That's it. We just never see it. And then Sonny shows up with the other Ventru, but has no lines. He's just like, he just shows up at the very end of the episode. It's like with Frank and Sonny, they didn't have anything for them to do in this episode. But because they're contracted, they probably had to write him in for something. For something. And nobody cries over Eddie's death, by the way. Not even his sire.
No, because Eddie smells a setup coming from his sire. Because when his sire says that he's sending the Asimite as backup for Eddie.
Yep.
He was like, I don't think so, because I would trade you in, and I think you're doing the same thing to me, so there's nothing I can do about it, so I'm just going to play through this hand. Pretty much. And he's accepted that his sire has basically put him in this trap, and there's no way to get around it, and he probably won't survive.
Yeah.
Because even if he did take being prince of the city, his sire would then take his head to make himself prince of that city too. So he would be both LA prince and San Francisco prince, which I'm not sure you could even really effectively rule two places that far apart.
By the way, also, why didn't we get a scene where to keep up the illusion that Jillian is dead, that we see a scene where Cash tells Sasha that her uncle is been killed? And that would have been like a great scene between Sasha and Brute and Eddie, which we never see. There is no interaction between Eddie and Sasha other than like him staring at her from a distance in the episode Romeo and Juliet. And then that's really it. We never get a Sasha-Eddie scene. She's now a Bruja. He's the Bruja Primogen. His blood is now in her veins, if that's how it works. We never saw those two ever interact with each other. They're in the same scene together, but they never interact with each other.
I think it's because Eddie's focus is more on Julian and just the idea that Sasha is now Bruja, that he doesn't need to flaunt it. He can just use his words, and that's plenty.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And then Julian goes over to Caitlin's house, and there's this terrible line of, how can you imagine your life without... I can't imagine my life without you, so I want to be with you. Let's make out. But however, how can you imagine your life without him? He's your boss. You're going to see him every single day, woman. What?
Yeah.
This isn't like an end of the breakup relationship. He's still your boss. He owns the newspaper. You're the city editor-in-chief. You have to see him.
Yeah, I think that this inappropriate working relationship, if it were to continue, it probably wouldn't be continuing for long, because if she got freaked out over a couple of pictures, there's no way that she could be out in public with him, show any sort of affection for him, officially be dating each other. It's like a secret relationship, and yep, those types of things don't last.
Nope. It just doesn't, yeah. It just, it was bound to end, especially when you eventually found out he was a vampire, because,
yeah.
I'm sorry, at some point while the two of you were screwing, which will happen in the next episode, he's gonna, like, haul off and try and bite you. It's just the way it is.
I think he has a bit more control over his base instincts, but, you know.
Maybe.
She would get that secondary effect, like how Frank had from Alexandra. You know, that sense of power and confidence and strength just from having this sexual fluid contact and exchange.
Sexual fluid contact. I like the sound of that. It just flows right off the tongue.
Yeah, sexual fluid contact.
Well, that's pretty much it for this episode of Kindred: The Embrace, the death of Eddie Fury, which was the other title it could have been, but the rise and fall of Eddie Fury. There's no rise in this episode. It's just a lot of falling for Eddie.
I mean, if you consider that he rose for that split second before anyone actually kissed his ring.
Yeah. So, that is it for the Dead TV Podcast with this episode. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook at the Dead TV Podcast, as well as our website, RadioHorror.com. And if you feel so inclined to want to help out the Dead TV Podcast, we do have a Patreon page that you can go to. It's Radio of Horror, and you can drop some money in the bucket there, become a sustaining follower of our show. Give us a hand with paying for expenses that we might have.
We value all of your comments and critiques. Please send us a comment. Rate our podcast
on iTunes. Yes, we are at 6 ratings right now. I want that thing over 10 for every episode. I would like 1 rating. So please do. You can also check out Mr. Zeneca at her sites,
elegantlykinky.com.
And you also have an event coming up too, don't you?
I do. It's a
vampire related
party.
Yes.
Well, no, the vampire one is in August.
Oh, but, okay. Gotcha.
The next event is February 25th, and that is a rainbow glow party.
Oh, okay. All right, so the vampire event's in August. All right. Well, we'll be finished up with Constantine by then, so.
True.
All right. Thank you, everybody, and thank you once again to Jessel Lantern for providing us with our theme music, which you will hear now at the very end of the bumper for this episode of the Dead TV Podcast. I am Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Zeneca.
Saying have a good night.